From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the tsunami is affecting rebel and militant Islamist groups in Indonesia and what that means for the West. We talk with Sydney Jones, director of the International Crisis Group's Southeast Asia Project. She was deported from Indonesia last June after writing a report on the country's chief terrorist group. Last week on our show, the Wall Street Journal's air travel columnist recommended against purchasing long-term tickets on U.S. Airways in case they go under. We'll talk with the head of corporate affairs at U.S. Airways, who says he's confident the airline will survive. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the use of the word Democrat with a small d. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the tsunami struck, most Americans were unfamiliar with Aceh, the province in Indonesia, which is the area hardest hit by the wave. About 115,000 people were killed in the region and 800,000 left homeless. My guest, Sydney Jones, is an expert on political conflict in Indonesia, including the Aceh separatist movement. She's also studied militant Islamic groups operating in Indonesia. Jones is the Southeast Asia Project Director of the International Crisis Group, which studies conflicts around the world. Last June, after writing an in-depth report on Indonesia's chief terrorist group, she was deported by the government. Since then, she's been based in Singapore. We invited her to talk with us about her work in Indonesia, the impact of the tsunami on political and militant groups in Indonesia, and how U.S. aid efforts might affect how we are perceived there. The U.S. is giving more money and aid to tsunami victims than Saudi Arabia or other Muslim countries. Is that likely to win us goodwill in Indonesia?
I think it's likely to win some goodwill, but I think it's important to understand that the bad image of the United States in a place like Indonesia is based on such a wide range of factors, exacerbated by the war in Iraq and what's perceived as the one-sided support for Israel and the Arab-Israeli conflict. There's still a huge amount of suspicion out there, a lot of discussion that you see both in the Indonesian media and on Indonesian websites about what's the real agenda of the United States in helping out. Are they really doing this because they want to help Acehnees, or are they doing this because they want oil, or because they want to Christianize parts of Indonesia, or so on. So the suspicion is there, even with the extent of the humanitarian effort that's being made. I should say, though, that the one place that is universally welcoming the United States is Aceh, where the problem is.
Well, let's get to that in 1 second. You mentioned that one of the concerns is that we would try to Christianize the people there. I've read concerns in the newspaper that some Muslim leaders are afraid that people bringing aid will try to proselytize about Christianity. Why is that a concern?
There are two factors here. One is that there's a belief that's very widespread in Indonesia more generally that the United States doesn't do anything out of pure motives, and that because of the fact that the war on terror since 9/11 has been perceived very strongly in Indonesia as a war on Islam, it therefore follows for these people that the United States, when it does something in Indonesia, is doing something that is intrinsically against Muslim interests. And usually that's related to spreading infidel influence or kafir influence or Christianizing Indonesia. In fact, this belief is particularly strong in the most militant side of the Muslim population. It isn't universally held, but it was exacerbated by this incident last week where an organization based in Virginia called World Help talked about taking 300 Acehnees orphans to the United States to convert them to Christianity, and it just fueled the paranoia that exists in some parts of the population.
Do a lot of the aid groups proselytize?
No, most of them don't have any interest in proselytizing whatsoever. And the interesting thing is that Aceh for so long had been closed completely to international agencies and the foreign media. And with this disaster, it's been a free-for-all. Everybody, anybody can go in. So there have been some groups that are not necessarily reputable aid agencies going in with the mix. And among them, there may be some that have some kind of religious agenda. But for the most part, these agencies are there as professional humanitarian aid workers.
Now, you said that although many Indonesians are really suspicious of America's motives in helping tsunami victims, the one place that Americans really are being welcomed is Aceh, which is the place that was hardest hit by the tsunami. Why is that?
There are a number of different reasons. First of all, I think simply because the U.S. military forces in particular opened up a major logjam in the delivery of aid and were able to use their equipment to basically get supplies to the most devastated part of this province, which was on the west coast. And I think Achenes across the board are grateful for that. There was extensive press coverage. There was extensive television coverage of the U.S. role. So just by the sheer gratitude for the humanitarian aid in Aceh is one factor. But the second factor is in some ways more interesting. It's that Aceh and its independence movement, which has been in existence for years but has taken this particular form of a guerrilla struggle since 1976, is desperate for United States support. And this is the reason why it's just inconceivable that this part of Indonesia, which is so deeply, deeply Islamic, would never think twice about joining an international jihad, because they really want American and more generally Western support for their independence struggle. They're not going to get it, but they want it.
Why do they think they would get it?
There are a number of factors. I think there's the head of this guerrilla movement, which is called GAM, G-A-M, which is an acronym for the Free Aceh Movement. The head of it believes that the United States has traditionally supported Aceh ever since it was a sultanate in the 19th century. And when you meet him, he pulls out this letter from Ulysses S. Grant to the Sultan of Aceh and uses this as proof that the United States from the very beginning has recognized Aceh as a separate territory and as a separate country. Now, it's a long way from that particular historical incident to support now for independence. It's not going to happen. No country around the world supports the independence of Aceh. But it doesn't mean that the groups in Aceh and the pro-independence movement doesn't stop trying to get that support.
So what is their fight about? Why do they want independence? What's their problem with the Indonesian government?
There are a couple of factors, and it's changed a bit over time. For many years, even before Indonesia was independent from the Dutch, this used to be the Dutch East Indies, and when the Dutch colonized Indonesia, it was the Achenese that fought longest and hardest against Dutch rule, and they developed this very proud sense of resistance to central authority, which has continued up to this present day. And then they thought they were going to get some kind of special status in the new republic, which they didn't get. And that started a struggle from about the early 1950s. That particular episode of independence struggle was defeated by the Indonesian army. It rose up again in the 1970s with issues of economic exploitation by the central government in Jakarta of Aceh's very considerable mineral wealth. And then there was a major counterinsurgency campaign by the Indonesian army where major atrocities were committed in the late 1980s, early 90s, particularly 1990, 91. And then part of the independence struggle came as an issue of justice. We want justice for past abuses, and since we're not getting it from the Indonesian government, therefore that's an additional reason for why we should be independent. So it's changed over time. It's complex, but it involves economic, historical, cultural, and political factors.
Well, Aceh, the region in Indonesia hardest hit by the tsunami, and the region with this independence movement, has been closed off. Why was it closed off until the tsunami?
Indonesia and these guerrillas entered into negotiations in 2000, in May 2000, and these talks collapsed in 2003, in May 2003, and it was at that stage that the Indonesian government declared martial law. And when they declared martial law, Aceh was basically closed down, and it was shut off both to international agencies, international non-governmental organizations, humanitarian organizations, as well as the foreign press. Now, it wasn't completely shut off to the foreign media. There were some newspapers that were able to get in, but only after an incredibly long bureaucratic struggle. So effectively, for the last 18 months, there haven't been any foreigners to speak of in Aceh. And that's what makes this incredible contrast between the day before the tsunami, when there was virtual total military operations in Aceh, save for the capital, and the day after the tsunami, when you began to get the wave of international relief workers coming in.
I guess that helps explain why some of the rebels are telling Westerners, you're welcome here and we won't hurt you.
Yes, I think it's both because the rebels are very much interested in international legitimacy. They want to be recognized. They want to be seen to be welcoming to the international community that might support talks that would lead to, if not independence, some far greater degree of autonomy than Aceh has now. But also, it's just unthinkable that the guerrillas would have any interest in harming foreign workers in this kind of situation, because their own people, the Achenese, would suffer for it.
But the rebels did have a reputation for kidnapping outsiders before the tsunami.
They had a reputation for kidnapping other Indonesians. They didn't take foreigners.
Oh, I see. Okay. So they've never really targeted foreigners?
No.
My guest is Sydney Jones. She's the head of the International Crisis Group's Southeast Asia Project. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sydney Jones. She's the Indonesia Project Director of the International Crisis Group. This is a group that analyzes conflicts around the world. Are the Islamic militant groups participating in the aid efforts at all?
Well, we've seen a number of groups going up. But again, just as every relief group under the sun internationally is going to Aceh, likewise, every organization domestically from every religious stripe, from every political stripe, is going up to Aceh. And among the groups that have gone up are several groups with a militant reputation. These include a group called the Majlis Mujahideen Indonesia, or the Indonesian Mujahideen Council, that's led by Abu Bakar Bashir, who himself is on trial as we speak for terrorism charges. We also have something called the Islamic Defenders Front, which is known in Indonesian as FPI, which goes around smashing up nightclubs and going after anything that is not in accordance with Islamic law. And they're basically thugs with an Islamic veneer. They're up in Aceh, you know, helping at one level evacuate people and bury corpses and so on. But on the other hand, they're also looking to translate what's going on in Aceh into grist for their particular mill.
So there are Islamic extremist groups who are trying to capitalize on the tsunami and use it to convert people to their agenda.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to work. And I think Aceh and the Achenese are particularly resistant to this kind of proselytizing, partly because many of these groups have their base in Java. And one of the real complaints that the Achenese have toward the rest of Indonesia is that it's allowed the Javanese, the major ethnic group in Indonesia, to colonize them. And no Achenese likes to be told what to do by anybody from outside Aceh.
How important is Indonesia as a base for terrorists and for training, for organizing?
Within Southeast Asia, it's played a very important role, but the interesting thing is that the training has usually taken place outside of Indonesia. The biggest spurt in growth of this kind of organization was when Indonesians went to Afghanistan from about 1985 to 1994 and trained there with the foreign fighters from the rest of the Middle East and Pakistan and a range of other countries. That gave an indigenous group in Indonesia that was already opposed to Suharto, the previous president, the lethal skills they needed to actually turn themselves into a militant group. And now the leadership of the biggest terrorist organization, Jamaah Islamiyah, is composed mostly of people who had experience in Afghanistan during that period. Then from 1994, roughly, up until quite recently, and probably until today, there was training going on in Mindanao in the southern Philippines. There have been small training classes, backyard efforts basically, organized in Indonesia, but the big training has come outside the country.
Are any of the terrorist groups in Indonesia connected to Al-Qaeda?
Jamaah Islamiyah has had ties to Al-Qaeda, and one of its members, Hambali, who's now in U.S. custody, we don't know where exactly, is believed to have been on the central leadership structure of Al-Qaeda. Clearly, the Bali bombs in October 2002 and some of the other major bombing operations got financing from Al-Qaeda, but Jamaah Islamiyah was never just a spoke in the wheel. It wasn't a franchise of Al-Qaeda. It was very much an independent organization that made its own plans, had its own agenda, but did get some funding.
So is the agenda of these groups in Indonesia more about issues in Indonesia than it is about other Western, you know, about Western countries?
It's very much an Indonesia-focused agenda, but since there was a fatwa from Al-Qaeda in February 1998 urging attacks on the U.S. and its allies, there's been one group within this Indonesian organization which has urged the destruction of the enemy of Islam, which it defines as the United States. This is Jamaah Islamiyah.
This is Jamaah Islamiyah.
And that particular group has been responsible for all of the bombings that we've seen. Now, I should underscore as well that while
the bombings in Indonesia, like in the Bali nightclub?
Like in the Bali nightclub, like in the Marriott Hotel in August 2003, like in front of the Australian Embassy in September of 2004, and a number of other bombings as well. Also, this same group has been responsible for a number of extremely serious bombings that took place in Mindanao in the southern Philippines. It's an organization which is dominated by Indonesians, but which has had a regional reach with cells in Malaysia, Singapore, and the Philippines itself, but with people that are overwhelmingly of Indonesian nationality, some Malaysians and some Singaporeans, although most of the Singaporeans are now locked up.
You've spent a lot of time in Indonesia, although you're not there any longer because you were basically asked to leave the country, which we'll get to in a minute. I'd like to talk with you a little bit about how you learned so much about the terrorist groups there and the militant Islamic groups. First of all, how did you first get to Indonesia and studying the crises there?
Well, I first went to Indonesia, oddly enough, as my first job out of graduate school. I'd been working on a degree in Middle Eastern studies and applied to the Ford Foundation for a job, and they gave me a job in Jakarta. And like all serendipitous things, it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me.
So how did you start getting on good enough terms with people in these groups that they would actually talk with you?
Well, this is another interesting aspect. When I was working as the Indonesia researcher at Amnesty International in London in the mid-1980s, some of these people that were either in or on the fringes of Jamaah Islamiyah were then at the forefront of the battle against repression by Suharto. And Amnesty took up some of these cases, not any of the real terrorists, but some of the people on the fringes, as prisoners of conscience for issuing newsletters that were highly critical of the Suharto government, but very militantly Islamic, but they didn't advocate violence at that stage. And these people were arrested for subversion, and we championed their cause. And they knew we championed their cause, and they knew that I was the researcher. So when many years later, in 2002, when I went back to Jakarta to live and decided to make contact with some of these people, they welcomed me at that stage with open arms because I had been campaigning for their release in 1985, 1986. And that started the process of getting additional information. They subsequently, however, these same people decided that I was a traitor after publishing information that suggested that they were now up to no good.
Well, have you changed your mind about the actions that landed them in prison when you were working with Amnesty International and considered them prisoners of conscience?
No, and if one person, for example, was publishing this newsletter that was full of very strong anti-Suharto language from an Islamic perspective, but reading that newsletter today, I would go to bat for this person again if he were imprisoned on the same charges for publishing that same magazine.
Cindy Jones is the Southeast Asia Project Director of the International Crisis Group. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of astrologer Susan Miller's The Year Ahead 2005, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Warner Home Video, announcing Warner Gangsters, 6 DVD sets featuring Bogart, Cagney, and Robinson. Available January 25th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, getting deported from Indonesia after reporting on the country's chief terrorist group. Also, we talk about the restructuring of U.S. Airways. And Jeff Nunberg considers the evolution of the word Democrat with a small d. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Cindy Jones, the head of the International Crisis Group's Southeast Asia Project. She was based in Jakarta until the Indonesian government deported her last June, following the release of her report on the country's chief terrorist group. She's continuing her work from her new home in Singapore. Before joining the International Crisis Group, she worked with Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Well, you traced one of the Islamic extremist groups to a boarding school in Indonesia that many of the extremists attended from Jamaah Islamiyah. Can you tell us a little bit about this boarding school and why it became a hub?
This is an interesting school. It's in a little town outside Solo in central Java, in a little village called Ngruki, N-G-R-U-K-I. And Ngruki is the place that produced Mr. Abu Bakr Bashir, this man who's now on trial. He founded the school in about 1971. And the school became a place where many people who were interested in really living by Islamic law went to study. He also had a partner, a man named Abdullah Sunkar, and it was Sunkar who helped a lot of people get to Afghanistan as mujahideen in the 1980s. And there was also this long tradition in Indonesia of rural Muslim boarding schools having very charismatic founders or teachers. And once you study there, you don't lose the bond with that teacher, even though you go on to do other things. So you're always coming back to visit with the man that inspired you in your career as a Islamic teacher or in whatever walk of life you chose to engage in. So Ngruki became the hub for a lot of the activities of the people who later became the core group of Jamaat Islamiyah. And if we look at the people involved in the bombings that have taken place across the region, really, from the year 2000 onwards, many of those people were graduates of Ngruki between about 1989 and about 1996. So it really did become the key school. We called it the Ivy League of Jamaat Islamiyah, and there are a number of other schools, about 18 altogether, that have produced these bombers.
Is there a comparison that could be made between this school and the schools in Pakistan that trained so many Afghani refugee boys in extremist Islam?
There's a major difference, which is interesting. In Pakistan, there really wasn't an alternative for people who wanted to go to school. You either went to these extremist schools or you didn't go to school at all. And families often were too poor to have any other option. In Indonesia, it wasn't a case of poverty. Almost everybody who went to these schools at least had an option of going to secular schools, and in some cases did go for part of their educational career to secular schools. We have people in the leadership of this organization who graduated from expensive tertiary institutions, colleges and universities, people who were veterinarians, people who were technical experts, people who were civil engineers. So it wasn't a question that poverty was what drew them into these schools. It was it was both a deliberate choice, the model set and provided by people like the two men who founded this school, Bashir and Sunkar, but also another factor which we haven't mentioned, which is that there was a rebellion in Indonesia in the 1950s in about three parts of the country to establish an Islamic state, people who weren't happy with the way this new independent republic was turning out. And it's often the sons of the people who fought in that rebellion who have become the core members of Jamaat Islamiyah. The rebellion was called Darul Islam, and the importance of Darul Islam for the current terrorist movement is hard to underestimate.
Some of the leaders of Jamaat Islamiyah are people who you defended as prisoners of conscience back in the 80s when you worked with Amnesty International. You get to Indonesia in the 90s, you talk to them, you interview them, they become your sources, and then you write this report describing how they're connected in this extremist group, a group that's behind several of the terrorist bombings. You talk about the school that connects them, and they realize, well, they decide you're not a friend and you're not, they no longer want you as a source. What kind of personal interactions did you have with the people who you'd spoken with after the report was published?
Well, they tried to sue me, for one thing. They brought a criminal defamation complaint against me, suggesting that I had slandered the good name of Abu Bakr Bashir, among other things. In fact, there was one point in December 2002 where I had four different threatened lawsuits. None of them materialized. And in this case, the police just didn't pay any attention to the criminal defamation suit. The funny thing was that when I was asked to leave Indonesia by the man who was then head of the Central Intelligence Agency in Indonesia, he became enemy number one in some ways, but these people in the real hardcore militant groups didn't like him either. And on the day before I left Indonesia, one of these people called me up. This is the same person who brought the criminal defamation suit and said, we hear you have things against Hendro Priyono. This is the name of the man in the intelligence agency. Do you want to work together? I thought the last thing I want is to work with you guys.
So the fact that they were enemies was more important than the fact that the extremists were seeing you as an enemy.
Yeah, it's one of the old, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, put into practice.
Well, I find it interesting that there were lawsuits as opposed to death threats against you. Were there death threats too?
No, I never got any threats. I mean, we were worried about this at one stage, that there might be threats or might be some kind of action taken against us. But no, it was all perfectly above board and through the courts, not through any kind of threatened violence. And I think basically that these people had bigger fish to fry. These are people that think through undertaking spectacular acts of bombings of symbolic targets. That's why they chose a hotel, for example, called the Marriott, that people would associate with an American company. That's why they went after a nightclub in Bali that was filled with tourists from all these different countries, and well known not only as a nightclub spot in Bali, but more importantly, perhaps, as a place where Indonesians were not allowed to go. So it had a reputation among the Indonesians on Bali, and not a very good one. So they're not going to be interested in going after somebody like me.
What were the official reasons you were deported?
We never really got a formal list until September. And in September...
And you were deported in June.
I was deported in June. When this letter finally came, it was ludicrous. It was everything under the sun. I had slandered the government on Aceh and Papua. I had misused my work permit, which said I was based in Jakarta, and yet I traveled outside the capital. I had given a lecture in Washington where I said, according to them, that the Indonesian army was spreading HIV/AIDS in Papua, which is, I don't know where they got that one from, and a range of other things. They also said that I had exposed an agent of the intelligence agency in a way that compromised their network, which was also ridiculous, because I did meet this man. But I met him because he'd been exposed in a major magazine article, and I got his telephone number from the magazine article.
Although you've been deported from Indonesia and are now based in Singapore, you remain the Indonesia Project Director of the International Crisis Group. What's it like for you to have to operate from a distance now?
It's so frustrating, particularly now. I spent so much of my time working on Aceh, and I love this place. I've gone back and forth to it. I have a lot of Achenese friends. And when this tsunami hit and you saw the images of the city that I know like the back of my hand just destroyed, it was heartrending. I want to be anywhere in the world but where I am now. I want to be particularly back in Indonesia doing something that if I could for Aceh.
But they won't let you in.
I can't go in.
You know, I've kept this conversation really not about the victims of the tsunami, but more about the larger, you know, political and extremist repercussions. I want to get back to the victims of the tsunami. I'm sure many of your friends are among the people who have either been killed or displaced by it. Can you talk a little bit about a little more of your personal understanding of how the tsunami has affected the people of Aceh?
Well, just this afternoon, for example, I talked to a friend of mine who is a human rights activist in Aceh who was in Jakarta when the tsunami hit. His wife and child, however, were in Banda Aceh. And he got word that they were safe about the second day. So he had about 48 hours not knowing whether they were safe or not. But he lost both his parents and 15 other relatives in Mulabo, in the town in West Aceh. So, and yet you talk to him on the phone, and he's matter of fact about it now, but I can't imagine what it must be like just to have your family devastated in one blow. And, you know, you're grateful for the fact that your immediate family survived, but with your parents gone just like that, it's got to be something you can't imagine. And other people as well. There's a lot of concern in among my friends for the journalists in who worked for the local newspaper in Aceh. There was a paper called Serambi, and Serambi had its office right on the coast, and they were having their end of year meeting when the wave hit, and the building was largely destroyed. Apparently the force of the wave just pushed the printing presses out of the building virtually. And there's a large number of both journalists and employees of the paper who went missing. Among them, one of the people that I knew very well, who was one of the best, most fearless editors you could possibly imagine, a guy named Muharram Noor. Lovely, lovely guy. And he's one of the people who's still missing but presumed dead. And there's so many people in those circumstances, you know, how their family's going to get closure when you don't know for sure, for absolute sure, what happened to them.
Cindy Jones, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Cindy Jones is the Southeast Asia Project Director of the International Crisis Group. Our interview was recorded yesterday. This morning, the foreign minister of Indonesia said he hoped to begin talks later this month with GAM, the separatist rebel group in Aceh. Cindy Jones told us this morning that she thinks this is the best opportunity the Acehnese have had in some time, and it's to the credit of all those concerned that they are giving this a chance. In the meantime, Aceh remains in a state of civil emergency. Coming up, what's ahead for U.S. Airways? This is Fresh Air. Last week, we spoke with Scott McCartney. He writes the Wall Street Journal column on air travel called The Middle Seat. He recommended that flyers avoid buying tickets on U.S. Airways for summer travel because the airline, which is in bankruptcy, might not be around if they don't get through the financial hurdles they face in the next few weeks. But the airline's vice president of corporate affairs, Chris Chimes, told us he's confident that U.S. Airways will make it over those hurdles.
Well, actually, we've cleared some in the last few days. We have reached agreement with the Federal Loan Guarantee Board, the ATSB, to allow us to use cash through June 30th, which is our target date for emergence from Chapter 11. So for the customer, that says we have approval and adequate cash to operate through the summer. The late spring and summer is our most traditionally profitable period. So we're going to be building cash during this period and making money, hopefully. So we're optimistic about the future. The second hurdle we've cleared is we have an agreement with General Electric, which is our largest creditor, to finance airplanes and provide some other cash resources to us. We had to meet some other tests, which we did, and it was announced on Friday. So both of those are significant hurdles that we've cleared and provide some very positive momentum going forward.
And I think you're asking for concessions from the Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, who vote on January 21st.
That's right. The IAM represents our mechanics and our baggage handlers and some other workers. They are in the process of ratifying new labor agreements that the results will be announced on Friday the 21st. We can't prejudge the outcome, but we're very hopeful that those will be both agreements will be ratified, and that'll be the final labor concessions and labor agreements that we had to get done.
Now, I know you say you're confident that U.S. Air won't go under, but for any consumers who are less sure than you are, say hypothetically you didn't clear all these hurdles and U.S. Air did go under, what would happen to flyers holding U.S. Air tickets?
Well, I'm going to back up a second we all need to recognize that the airline business is a very competitive industry. It's in the interest of our competitors that we go away. And so some of the whispering about our prospects, clearly has some competitive slant to it. And my guess is there were lots of disappointed people around the industry over the past couple of weeks as we have met the various milestones we had to achieve. Moving forward, we have the cash to operate through the rest of our restructuring, the June 30th target being when we hope to emerge from Chapter 11. If, in fact, the world unravels and customers are concerned about the tickets they hold on U.S. Airways or any other airline with financial problems, Congress has extended a law that provides protection for customers so that other airlines must honor the tickets of an airline that liquidates. So customers have protection. If they purchase on a credit card, which 95% of all customers do, they also have protection through their credit card companies. So there are various ways that the consumer has some confidence in their purchase, and that they really should dwell on that, frankly.
Some consumer experts are suggesting that if you have frequent flyer U.S. Air miles, this would be a good time to transfer them to another airline. What do you say to that?
Well, there's something about frequent flyer miles that I don't fully understand, and that people in general hoard them for some unknown purpose. My advice to any customer, whether it be a U.S. Airways frequent flyer or Delta or American or anyone else, is those frequent flyers aren't like a mutual fund that increases value in the future. And so spend them. Surprise your family with a weekend trip. Give your parents a trip to someplace they have always wanted to go. But to sit on hundreds of thousands of miles like they're going to increase in value and you're going to live off them in retirement isn't really a smart thing. And I think customers in general need to kind of get over that and use them rather than hoard them.
Is there a point where, the all clear is sounded and U.S. Airways can say for certain that it's going to survive?
Well, frankly, I don't think there's a point right now for any airline to say with certainty all's clear. I mean, every airline is negotiating with their labor groups for cost reductions at some level or the other. Every major airline continues to lose money. And so, for U.S. Airways, clearly when a plan of reorganization is confirmed by the bankruptcy court is a very positive thing. We're working towards that. But, the industry is in turmoil, and every airline is grappling with, losing hundreds of millions of dollars respectively since 9/11. The industry's changing, and where airlines will be 3 or 5 years from now isn't something that I or anyone else can predict right now with certainty. So the industry is going to continue to change. 15 years ago, we probably couldn't have envisioned a world without TWA and Pan Am and Eastern, and those airlines are gone, and the airlines that are going to remain relevant are the ones that are relevant to the customer, and that's what we're trying to do here. And so, it's a good time to be an airline customer in that there are lots of bargains out there. It's not a great time to be an airline manager because you're struggling with pretty difficult issues as far as financial losses and changes to the business.
Chris Chimes, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Chris Chimes is the Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs at U.S. Airways. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the use of the word Democrat with a small d. This is Fresh Air. President Bush described himself last week as a Republican Democrat. That's Democrat with a small d. When we talk about small d Democrats, it's almost always in reference to people in places like Russia or Iraq, not to Americans. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg says the president's comment signaled a revival of the word in American politics.
Political language is a matter of artful reinterpretation, neutralizing the words your opponents have used against you and making slogans out of the ones that everyone takes for granted. Take President Bush's use of the word Democrat in his remarks on the recent Palestinian elections and the Iraqi elections on January 30th. As a Democrat, he said, as a person who believes in democracy, a Republican Democrat, I might add, as someone who believes that everybody has a right to live in a free society, January 2005 is an extraordinary month. Of course, small d Democrat isn't exactly a rare word, but nowadays we tend to reserve it for people in places like Russia, Iraq, or Ukraine, where the system of government is up for grabs. When we describe Americans as small d Democrats, it's generally in a purely social sense, when we want to praise some aristocrat for a seeming indifference to class distinctions. A couple of weeks ago, the New York Times reviewer of a posthumous collection of George Plimpton's essays described the writer as a Democrat of the First Order. It struck me you could have said the same thing about Rodney Dangerfield, except who would have bothered? That's pretty much the reason why Americans rarely bother to describe themselves as small d Democrats in the political sense of the word, to mean somebody who advocates democracy. That's supposed to go without saying. But until the 20th century, Democrat was a charged term in political life. In the age of Jefferson and Jackson, Americans were still aware that the word had been borrowed from French at the time of the French Revolution, when the idea of rule of the people could evoke the alarming echoes of tumbrils in the streets. And at the end of the 19th century, William Jennings Bryan still saw a clear connection between the small d and big d senses of Democrat and Democratic, both of them opposed to words like plutocrat and aristocrat. In fact, Bryan often used the word democracy as a synonym for the Democratic Party itself. It wasn't until the 20th century that the word democracy became part of the American rhetorical wallpaper, stripped of most of its connotations of social and economic equality, this around the same time the phrase the people ceased to evoke the common man. In fact, nowadays the phrase economic democracy is only about a tenth as common in the press as it was in the Roosevelt years, and nobody uses it in political discussions for fear of calling up phrases like income redistribution and class warfare. And once democracy was safely disconnected from its more egalitarian implications, it no longer conjured up the specters of mob rule and despotism that made writers like Kant and Burke so wary of the word. It's simply a symbol that creates a sense of unity without connoting much of anything specific. As Walter Lippmann put it, it's one of those words that assemble emotions after they've been detached from their ideas. The bleaching of democracy made small d Democrat irrelevant as a political label. When an idea is universally accepted, you don't need a name for its adherents. Of course, the big D sense of Democrat persisted, but only as the name of a political affiliation that had no more independent meaning than old party names like Whig and Tory. That's what allowed the Republicans of Hoover's era to start referring to their opponents as the Democrat Party. The point of that was to suggest that there was nothing particularly democratic about a party whose support was based in urban political machines. But Republicans couldn't have gotten away with a maneuver if the earlier meaning of small d Democrat hadn't already faded from the public mind. By the mid-20th century, Democrat Party had become a routine partisan jab for Republicans, though nowadays it probably has less to do with undermining the Democrats than simply irritating them. Bush uses the phrase in campaign speeches, though he doubtless avoided it in a State of the Union address. In fact, it's such a partisan tick that I'm always a little surprised when I hear Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity talk about the Democrat Party on Fox News. I'd have figured they'd be more circumspect about tipping their hands. But now it's as if Bush himself is trying to redefine the phrase Democrat Party in a more meaningful way, as a name for his own political affiliation, Republican Democrats, as he puts it. What he actually means to suggest is that the true Democrats are the ones who see the elections in Iraq as justifying the administration's policies. Of course, some people might argue that Bush is using Democrat in a rather selective way, particularly in light of the other regimes that the administration has supported, Democracy may be on the march, but it seems to have a pretty restricted parade route. But there's this to be said for the way Bush uses small-d Democrat. It pulls democracy itself down off the mantelpiece and puts it back on the table for chewing over. Once a word becomes a partisan rallying cry, it can't continue to function as an object of uncritical universal veneration. It's as the 19th century historian Walter Badgett once said about the notion of royalty. Once you begin to poke about it, you can't reverence it anymore.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delacorte Press, publisher of Lighting Up, How I Stopped Smoking, Drinking, and Everything Else I Loved in Life Except Sex, by journalist Susan Shapiro. And from BBC America and the comedy Kumar's at Number 42, part improv, part talk show. Patrick Stewart guest stars tonight at 10 on BBC America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss faith and politics with Dr. Richard Land, president of the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and Reverend Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners Magazine and author of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.